Welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director at the JPC, and your host. We have a very large audience today. I know I've been saying this for weeks, but today's audience is totally amazing. So I'm going to introduce the JPC and our work again. If you've heard it before, well, you can hear it another time. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization providing analysis of foreign and domestic policy by leading scholars, academics, and commentators. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security relations, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity, which we think are especially important right this minute. You can read our publications, Insight articles, the In Context blog, Alliance Tracker and Frontline Defense, and our magazine In Focus Quarterly on our website at www.jewishpolicycenter.org. That's www.jewishpolicycenter.org. I am thrilled to have Dr. Jonathan Shanzer with us as our guest today. He is Senior Vice President for Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, where he oversees the work of the organization's experts and scholars. He's also on the leadership team of FTD's Center on Economic and Financial Power. As you can imagine, Iran sanctions are a big thing over there. Jonathan previously worked as a terrorism finance analyst in the U.S. Department of the Treasury, where he played an integral role in the designation of numerous terrorist financiers. He held previous think tank positions at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and the Middle East Forum, and he sat in my chair at the Jewish Policy Center. John, I hope I'm living up to the standards that you set, because those are really good standards. He has written hundreds of articles on the Middle East. You will find him everywhere that you look for articles in the Middle East, and you should look, and more than a dozen monographs and chapters for edited volumes. His three books are very important. My favorite is State of Failure, Yasser Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Unmaking of the Palestinian State, in which he talks about governance and Palestinian statehood issues, not having to do with Israel, but having to do with Palestinians. He also wrote Hamas versus Fatah, The Struggle for Palestine. A lot of people who advocate things like a two-state solution do not understand that Hamas and Fatah are in the middle of a civil war. And the third is Al-Qaeda and its armies, Middle East affiliate groups, and the next generation of terror. He testifies frequently before Congress and publishes widely in not only the American media, as I mentioned, but international media. He's been on Fox News, CNN, Arabic language television channels, and he has traveled extensively through the Middle East, speaking and learning. He earned his PhD from King's College in London, where he wrote his dissertation on Congress and its efforts to combat terrorism in the 20th century. Maybe today he can tell us how we're doing combating terrorism in the 20th century. He's going to talk about things blowing up in the Middle East. He's going to start with Syria, and he's going to move to Iran. As most of you know, things are blowing up. Sometimes Israel takes credit. Sometimes Israel takes blame. The Iranian government today said that the last two explosions were strictly accidental, not internal sabotage, not Israeli attacks. But that's what they have to say, because either of the other two options are not good for the government. So, John, what's happening in Syria? What's happening in Iran? And are long-term Iranian aims being thwarted? Maybe. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Shoshana. Great to be with all of you today. And it is, of course, always special to address a JPC crowd, given my past experience working there. I still get the emails from In Focus Quarterly, which is was sort of my brainchild when I started back at the JPC in, gosh, I guess it was 2007. We came up with this concept, Matt Brooks and I, and just really proud to see it continue and to see the work that Shoshana and her team have done to continue pushing the ball forward. So, again, just a pleasure to be with you today. Hope everybody's staying safe and sane. I know those are two very different things. All I can say is these are strange times, challenging times. I continue to remind my children that we are living history. We can't always say that in such a definitive way, but we certainly are now. And that's been something that's helped me during these trying times. I hope it helps put that in perspective for you as well. I am here today to talk about things blowing up in the Middle East. I want to talk briefly, or maybe not so briefly, about what's going on in Syria, which has been really a campaign that's gone on for the last 3 to 5 years, depending on who's counting. I want to speak a little bit about Lebanon because it has a direct bearing there, and then pivot at the end to what's happening in Iran and why it's happening. So let's start with Syria. As you know, over the last several years, really since 2012, there's been a civil war that's been going on there, and the Iranians have tried to exploit it. And by that, I mean that they have deployed Hezbollah, they've deployed Shiite militias, they've deployed their own IRGC fighters and commanders, and they are doing everything that they can to deploy hard assets, material, weaponry, as close as they can to the Israeli border. The goal is, quite frankly, to turn Tel Aviv into Seoul. They want to be able to surround Israel with rockets. They've already done it in Gaza. They've done it in Lebanon. Of course, in Gaza, you've got roughly 10 or 15,000 rockets there. In Lebanon, you've got 150,000 rockets, and they continue to threaten Israel. Israel, of course, has stood up the Iron Dome system, as well as some of the mid and long range systems that can shoot down these rockets with great accuracy. But if you saw the launch of all of them within a short period of time, there's no way that Israel would be able to survive that attack without sustaining massive damage. So this has been the goal of Iran for really the last 7 years. You could even argue that this goes back quite a ways before then, when you just think about the provision of rockets to Hamas in the early 2000s or before that, Hezbollah the same. So the strategy on Iran's part has been remarkably consistent. I would say that the efforts have really ticked upward with the fog of war settling in over Syria. It's just it's forced Israel to contend with one more front. And it's a challenging front because there's just very little visibility that the Israelis have. It's very hard for them to intervene in the same way that they have in the Gaza Strip, for example. Now, one thing that is, I think, worth noting, though, is that Iran is painfully aware of the fact that when they fire salvos through their proxies in Lebanon or in Gaza, the Israelis have been able to neutralize them with the Iron Dome systems and the other systems that I mentioned. And this has been really a thorn in the side of the Iranian leadership. They've spent a lot of time and money trying to move these weapons into the hands of their proxies, and then Israel has been able to foil them. In some cases, by the way, Israel has been more forward-leaning and has blown things up when they see caches of rockets in places that are convenient to strike. And as a result, Israel has been able to not just survive, but to thrive. But what has happened is the Iranians have decided in recent years that they need to up their game. The leadership in particular of the IRGC, and until somewhat recently, Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC, who was unceremoniously taken off the battlefield in early January by the U.S. Air Force, they have been spearheading an effort to develop what we now call PGMs, precision guided munitions. And the goal of this program is to take these dumb rockets. And you got to remember, the rockets that have been fired out of Lebanon and that have been fired out of Gaza, they sometimes fall short of their target and they will even land on the Gaza population. They'll fall far of their target and they'll hit the desert in the Negev, well past Israeli communities. The ones that fall on, or are destined to fall on Israeli targets, the Israelis have been able to shoot out of the sky, primarily because Iron Dome is able to assess the trajectory of these dumb rockets. They can see that if it goes up at a certain speed and it peaks at a certain place, it will go down at a certain speed. And this is how Iron Dome works. It works with math. It works with geometry. And so what the Iranians have decided to do is to try to turn their dumb rockets into smart ones, to turn these rockets into things that could potentially evade Iron Dome, that could use evasive tactics by being able to steer them from afar, to have them go north instead of south, to go east instead of west, to go up instead of down. And that has been the goal. Now, in some cases, Iran is able to build these from scratch. They have the indigenous capabilities. In some cases, they try to take the old rockets and retrofit them. For about $15,000 a pop, they can turn dumb rockets into smart ones. It's like sending them to college at about, I guess, a quarter of the total tuition, that at least these days that runs. And so what has been happening is that Syria has been the way station for all of this. What Iran does is it sends these parts, or sometimes the entire munitions, through Syria, where you have that fog of war, where it's difficult to track. And the goal has either been to set up PGM sites in Syria proper. Those are few and far between, but actually more to the point, they're trying to set them up in Lebanon, which has always been the destination of Iranian weapons, and Syria has long played that role. And so what we have seen over the last 5 years, give or take, is that there have been things that have been blowing up on a regular basis. Some of you have probably seen the YouTube videos of things blowing up on the tarmac at Damascus Airport. You've heard about Iranian leaders being killed right on the spot from Israel's own precision munitions. We've heard about convoys being destroyed. We've heard about all sorts of things that have been blowing up, including facilities, including warehouses in remote parts of Syria. Now, the reason for it, 9 times out of 10, maybe more, has been PGMs. The Israelis have called these weapons game-changing weapons. What they say is that if enough of these get into the hands of their enemies, then Israel will be in deep trouble. It will lack the ability to dominate the battle space as they have in recent years. And it's for that reason that this has been going on. The Israelis early on were very euphemistic about what they were striking, calling them game-changing weapons, but not saying much else about what it was that they were targeting. About 3 years ago, that changed. The Israelis started to own up to the fact that they were targeting PGMs. They are much more candid about why PGMs are a problem, and in fact, who's doing it. That it's the IRGC, and that Hezbollah is the primary recipient, and that the various Shiite militias are also taking part in this. The Israelis have identified that some of these Shiite militias have some of their own capabilities, however small. This includes even the Houthis in Yemen that the prime minister has also identified as being a recipient of Iranian PGMs. And of course, what we now know is that this could be extremely dangerous, not just for Israel, but for the rest of the region. Think about what happened to that Saudi oil facility last year when it was attacked with precision munitions. This took out one of the world's largest oil producing facilities in the world for several weeks. It could have been a lot worse. And so you just get a sense of what kind of damage this could bring. And then don't forget that we have US bases around the region. We've got US vessels that are traversing the Strait of Hormuz or the Red Sea. These are all things, or the Mediterranean for that matter, these are all things that should be of concern to the United States and not just Israel. But suffice it to say, the Israelis are always the tip of the spear. They have taken matters into their own hands in really a more aggressive fashion over the last 3 years or so, where they have waged something that is now commonly understand or commonly referred to as the war between wars, the WBW, also known as the campaign between wars, the CBW. The Israelis talk about this rather openly, and their goal is basically to stop PGMs from being amassed by the wrong people in high enough numbers that would likely prompt a full war. Not just these sort of one-off attacks and strikes that happen in the middle of the night that may or may not be claimed by the Israelis, but a full-on campaign to remove PGMs and even some of the dumb rockets as well, maybe other capabilities. What the Israelis continue to do is they try to forestall the conflict by establishing that dominance on the battlefield night after night. This has been the strategy. The Israelis continue to try to keep their powder dry for the potential of a showdown with Iran, which I'll get to in a moment. There's been actually very little in the way of stopping the Israelis in Syria. There's nothing that the Syrians can do in response. Their anti-aircraft systems are poor. Their hands are a bit tied with Russia there, with Iran there. I mean, it's just not a very coordinated response. When Israel does carry out these attacks, what you'll actually see are news reports where they complain bitterly about the fact that Israel just ate their lunch. And this happens on a regular basis. And, I think the Israelis are quite satisfied with the state of play over there. In fact, what the Israelis will quietly cede to me in conversations that are unattributable, but they'll say, look, we have complete and total intelligence dominance in Syria, which enables them to just take out not everything, but they will really have eyes on whatever comes through that territory. The real problem, quite frankly, right now is that some of them are slipping through to Lebanon. And that's where it's a bit more complicated for the Israelis to strike, because there is this standoff that has existed since the mid-2000s between Hezbollah and Israel. Israel is, of course, afraid of unleashing those 150,000 dumb rockets that I mentioned earlier. But what the Israelis continue to say is that Hezbollah is amassing PGMs at a greater rate than any of the other militias and proxies that Iran supports. This means that Hezbollah has roughly right now a few hundred PGMs. This is dangerous because A, it can evade Iron Dome, but B, they can strike within 5 to 10 yards of their intended target. Now imagine what this would mean if you can evade Iron Dome and then hit, for example, the alleged nuclear facility in Dimona, or the Kiryat, the so-called Pentagon of the Israelis in Tel Aviv, or the chemical plant in Haifa. You could create a mass casualty attack with a PGM strike, or just think for a minute that even if you're not able to evade Iron Dome, let's just say that for the sake of argument, there are 15 interceptors in a given Iron Dome battery, and you fire 16 PGMs at that chemical refinery in Haifa, one gets through, and with the precision, you can be sure that it will hit and that the damage would follow. So the Israelis are much more concerned about Hezbollah, and there are even talks right now, and this is a remarkable thing, they continue to warn that Lebanon could be flattened, could be turned into a parking lot, and that Israel will not wait around for this. But there are even discussions right now, as Lebanon is about to, it actually already has defaulted on $4.2 billion in Eurobonds. Its central bank is in debt up to roughly $24 billion, and its other banks are in debt. The total number, and FDD will be soon issuing a report, it's astronomical. It's twice what the worst bailout has ever been at the IMF in a country as tiny as Lebanon. So they are in really, really bad shape right now. And the Israelis are actually floating the idea that if the Lebanese armed forces and the Lebanese government, such as it is, would remove these PGMs, Israelis would go to bat for trying to help recapitalize the country, which is just a remarkable thing to think about, given the animosity that has long existed between Israel and its northern neighbor. But it is all for fear of these PGMs and the need to get it out. It also, obviously, this whole issue raises questions about why is the United States funding the Lebanese armed forces when they've allowed this to happen, where they've allowed these very dangerous weapons to fall into the hands of a non-state actor, and the Lebanese armed forces are helpless in mitigating this problem. So we've got a crisis on our hands in Lebanon. The Israelis are weighing right now what they can or should do about it. But of course, no one wants to wage a war. The last thing that Israel wants is a war that would probably evacuate a third of the country from the north and move them south. When you're trying to keep people apart from one another, the last thing you want to do is push them all together. So that's what's happening on the PGM front. It's a crisis in the making. In my view, it is likely the cause of the next major war in the Middle East. And I would say most Americans don't know what a PGM is. Most defense analysts probably know it through the U.S. Form of it, which is widely known as the JDAM, the Joint Direct Attack Munition, but people aren't thinking about it in terms of this gross violation of international norms of a terror-sponsoring state providing this high technology to non-state actors to threaten other sovereign nations. this is what is now pushing us to a crisis point, and the hope is that it doesn't happen amidst the pandemic. Now, this leads me to what the sort of last installment of things blowing up in the Middle East, and that is that we've seen over the last couple of weeks things blowing up in Iran. And it, actually, if we're going to be honest, this is not new. We've seen things blowing up in Iran dating back to 2019 as well. All of these attacks are unattributed. It's not as if the United States or Israel or anyone else is saying, yep, that was us, sorry, you know, we apologize. It's not happening that way. But we are seeing that, you know, every couple of nights, we're seeing something else go up in flames right now in Iran. I would tell you that that this is not a this is not just, you know, happenstance. There is a campaign that appears to be afoot. No one will claim credit for it. But what I can tell you is the conversations that I've had with some senior Israeli officials dating back just a few months ago. There was a sense, particularly as the Israelis got a handle on the coronavirus problem in their country, and the Iranians were still struggling with it mightily, that there was an opportunity. There was an opportunity for Israel to go on the offense while Iran remained on defense. And I think that that is a core thing to think about when we consider the possibility that Israel is behind all of this, or perhaps the likelihood that Israel is behind all of this. There's also, you know, timing is everything in terms of conflict, in terms of campaigns, in terms of pressure. So, you know, the other thing that the Israelis are, of course, thinking about is the fact that they have a window that is closing. And right now, the Trump administration has offered sort of a green light for Israel to be able to take action as it sees fit, with an election coming here in the United States in November, and with question marks lingering about what a Biden administration might or might not do. And let me just say here, I have no idea whether this would be something that would be approved of by the by a Biden administration. We actually hear right now that there is a fairly robust argument that's going on between the various advisors, those that are, let's call them from the pragmatic wing of the Democratic Party, and then there are those that are of the progressive wing, more in line with the kind of Bernie Sanders view of foreign policy. And I would say that they disagree vehemently on the utility of a campaign, if this is in fact a campaign that's being carried out by Israel. Who knows whether that green light would continue. So the Israelis, I think, see that this is the moment to strike enrichment facilities, to strike, in some cases, we've heard that some of the targets have been PGM parts warehouses. So they're actually taking out elements of that PGM program before they hit Syria, before they hit Lebanon. Very smart if it is in fact the Israelis. On top of that, you're looking at oil refineries, other things that might generate income for the Iranians. But what this looks like, at least from afar, would be a concerted campaign to weaken the Iranians further economically, amidst the economic sanctions campaign that the Trump administration has put on Iran, and of course attacks against nuclear facilities that might raise some questions about the continued illegal activity that Iran has been conducting with its nuclear program, taking out weapons that could soon be on the market as a result of the end of the arms embargo, which is coming in October. And then, of course, there'll be other things related to the ballistic missile program, et cetera, that may or may not be hit as this continues. But as I see it, this is the window that Israel, perhaps with the United States or even other allies, are exploiting. But so what they've done is they've decided, I think, at long last, to take that campaign between wars or war between wars away from just the traditional model of Israel attacking Iran's proxies and weakening those that seek to hurt Israel on its immediate border. And they've taken it to the enemy itself, to the heart of the conflict in Iran. If that is the case, it would be a remarkable shift. But of course, the Israelis are not talking, nor is the United States. So we'll have to continue to read and to learn about whether this is in fact a campaign or just a series of missteps and bumbling idiots on the Iranian side who can't stop blowing up their own facilities. So with that, I will end and hand it back over to Shoshana. I thank you again for the opportunity to chat with you today.
Thank you for enlightening us, John. We have a number of questions. You mentioned the ability of Israel to do pretty much what it would like to do in Syria. The Russians are okay with this. The Israelis talk to the Where do the Russians fit in that conversation?
You know, it's funny. The Russians obviously don't like what Israel's doing. It doesn't make them look good. They're not the sort of masters of this domain. But I've heard a little bit about what happens in these conversations. The Israelis have gone to Russia many times to deconflict with Mr. Putin and his advisors on what it is that the Israelis seek to do and have vowed to do and continue to do in Syria. And my understanding is the Israelis come in, it's not a friendly relationship, which I think some have mistakenly tried to color it. It's not that. It's a professional relationship between political leaders and military personnel, where Israel comes in and says, look, this is our neighborhood, and we have a problem. And the problem is in territory that you control either very clearly or nominally, and we are going to be doing some things about this. So we have a red phone, we have an ability to communicate with you, and we're going to let you know that this is what we're doing now. And we expect you to stand down. This is our neighborhood, and we expect you to respect that. My understanding is that the Russians have largely complied, and that there is a mechanism for deconfliction. Doesn't always happen, and there have been some moments of tension, as we all know. But what is particularly interesting to me is some of the color that I've heard from those who've been in the room, where allegedly Vladimir Putin listens and agrees and says, "Fine, we're willing to stand down." But by the way, I notice you're flying these American aircraft, which why don't you try one of my Sukhois? They're much better. Take it out for a test drive. We could be really good allies here. We could work together if you let us. And of course, the Israelis have very little interest in doing that, but respectfully decline and go on their way. But this is a constant thing with Vladimir Putin looking to supplant the United States in any way that he can. And the Israelis continue to push him off while continuing to ensure that a good relationship, a good professional working relationship exists.
Thank you. This leads right into the other superpower in the region, and that would be China. The Russians have always wanted to sell arms to anybody who would buy them. I'm interested that he's trying to sell them to Israel. The Chinese lately have been working the same angle. China and Iran have signed a very, very large deal for future investment in Iran by China. Leads to two questions. First of all, is China going to supplant Russia? Russia has sold a lot of stuff to Iran. And number two, is this big enough, and can the Chinese really afford this, to undermine the U.S. sanction campaign on Iran?
Well, I think I was actually on a call earlier today with a Trump administration official who was openly questioning whether Iran could make payment on any of this stuff. I mean, the idea that a relationship could be struck up where Iran pays China for whatever it receives, it's hard to imagine. I mean, you could potentially envision an arrangement whereby China establishes a bit more infrastructure in its Belt and Road Initiative in Iran in exchange for whatever Iran gets from China in return. This is not as a means for China to maintain a beachhead or a stronghold in the Middle East. This doesn't strike me as viable. And right now, with the pandemic being what it is, with oil prices being what they are, it really just doesn't seem that Iran has a lot to offer. If you kind of just take a look at the broader landscape, so I'm not sure exactly where this thing heads. I think it's from China's perspective, it's aspirational. From Iran's perspective, I think there is a deep desire to message to the Iranian people that things are still in hand, that things are under control, and that even as the pressure from the United States and the international community continues to mount, and as COVID cases spike and the country really seems to spiral out of control, I think there's a real desire on the part of the clerical regime to say, guys, here's our rescue package. It's coming. So everybody just take a deep breath as they try to ride out this conflict. I think that is a real possibility, that it's almost more for PR than anything else from the Iranian perspective. China, on the other hand, they've got real designs on the rest of the region, and they're looking for areas to exploit. The one thing that I would just note about this entire arrangement is that it should be a wake-up call for Israel. Israel has its own relationship with China. China has really tried to invest heavily, not just with the Haifa port, not just with Ashdod or with the building of the underground in Tel Aviv and elsewhere. You look at a lot of investment in the high-tech sector, attempts by the Chinese to acquire Israeli technology that could have AI applications or other applications for weapons of the future. These are all things that the Israelis have done in line with U.S. guidance, but that guidance is changing and the U.S. is getting antsy as a result of the heating up of this great power competition. To me, it seems like this decision of the part of the Chinese to engage directly with Iran and to demonstrate to Israel that its arch enemy is now an ally of the Chinese Communist Party, this is the moment for the Israelis to pull the cord. This is the moment for them to say, you know what, thanks but no thanks. We're going to go back to the United States and we're going to be working much more closely with them right now to ensure that they beat you in the development of these weapons. That would be my strong advice to the Israeli government. Of course, it's not that easy. The Chinese roughly account right now for somewhere between 10 to 15% of the Israeli economy. It's cheap goods coming in. It's they're purchasing goods coming out. And the Israelis, to be fair, did what every other country in the world has done for the last 20, 30 years, which is invest more deeply in China because it's cheap labor and cheap products. But that has to change. In my view, what we're seeing now on the part of China, given their designs on the rest of the world, their desire to supplant the U.S.-led system, Israel's going to have some choices to make. And by the way, so do a lot of our other allies, the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, the Egyptians. All these countries are going to have to think very carefully about how much they allow China to insinuate itself in the Middle East.
We need to do some of that ourselves.
We do.
We do. We need to do a lot of it. Let me remind our listeners that a couple of weeks ago, our guest was Brigadier General Reserves Asaf Oriom, and he talked a lot about Israel and China, Israel, the United States and China. The podcast is available on our website. So if you didn't have the opportunity to hear the general when he was with us, please go take a look at that because it underpins a lot of what you just heard from Jonathan Chancer. And I think it's a very useful background. Back into today's program. So if the China-Iran relationship is, as you say, largely aspirational and serves a political function, and with the Trump administration cracking down more heavily on money to Iran, how do they get the money to do all this stuff? Where or can they continue to do all this stuff? Money for Hezbollah, money for Hamas, money for precision weapons, money to ship all this stuff, money to pay off. How can they do this?
It's a good question, and not all of this is easy. Of course, a lot of it stemmed from oil, and the illicit sale of oil to countries like China. They were one of the buyers. The Russians were another buyer. Other countries have also asserted their right to buy, perhaps at lower levels or at lower prices. And the U.S. has worked very hard to cut that off. We've gotten a nice boost from, you want to look at kind of the silver lining to this COVID crisis. It is that the price of oil dropped significantly. The demand because of the global recession/depression, it has made it so that fewer people need as much oil. They're just not, they're not traveling as much. They don't need as much of it. So the Iranians, I think, have probably watched a significant drop off in recent months. And it's unclear how they make some of that back. That said, they have illicit networks the world over. I mean, what Iran has done over the years is it has stood up. It's not just money laundering at this point. They've insinuated themselves with drug dealers, with cocaine cartels. I have a colleague, Emanuele Ottolenghi, who's done terrific work on Hezbollah and Iran in Latin America. And that network is deep, it is broad, and it is extremely hard to crack. There have been some wins, but there are many of these networks that still exist. The tri-border area, as everybody knows, is a very lawless area. And this has been an area that's been exploited, again, not just by the cartels, but by Iran and its proxies. So you have that. You've got illicit activity in Europe. You've got illicit activity all around the Middle East, smuggling and the like. The other thing to just note is that the Iranians, of course, deprived their own people in order to provide this weaponry and assistance to its proxies. And this is one of the reasons why we've seen Iranians come out in the streets protesting against the regime. In fact, some of the refrains and chants that we've seen from the Iranian people have said that, we don't want to support Gaza. We don't care about Hezbollah. You know, the Houthis are not here. We want you to focus on us. We want you to handle our COVID problems. We want you to handle our the spiraling currency problems and the unemployment and all of the other issues that have long plagued Iran. And of course, this gets back to an old sort of truism that I think everyone is, I'm sure, aware of, if not for the fact that I probably parroted it, I don't know how many times while at the JPC. But terrorist groups and terrorist states do not make for good governance. It's just that's not how they prioritize things, right? They think about revolution. They think about violence. They think about overturning the rest of the world order, and they neglect their people at home. And we see it with Hamas. We see it with Hezbollah. We see it with all of these, the Taliban, all of these different groups, Islamic State. These are not people that are particularly good at governance. They're good at violence.
Which raises another interesting possibility. Some of the things that blow up inside of Iran look like one thing. Other things that blow up inside Iran look like sabotage. They look like things that came from the inside of Iran. Is there a possibility that some of those unhappy Iranians are actually blowing things up?
Look, anything's possible, and I certainly wouldn't discount it. I mean, I do think that there's an interesting idea of, whoever's doing this in Iran right now, are they acting alone? Or are they getting help from the outside, and it's done through people that are living on the inside? As opposed to, for example, foreign operatives that have, airdropped themselves into hostile territory and then have to operate in the shadows. Maybe you have people that are operating more out in the open. Who knows? I mean, it's so hard to tell right now. I mean, there are lots of different guesses out there. I certainly don't have the answers, but I would not be surprised if we found out in the history books that are, that will be written 5-10 years from now, hopefully documenting the unraveling of the regime in Iran, that there were Iranians that were trying to assist in the unraveling of this regime.
Unraveling the regime, possibly another word for regime change. Is it your view that the United States and or Israel are attempting to overthrow the regime, or is this limited to limiting the damage the regime can do outside?
I mean, look, it's as you well know, it's a dirty word or a dirty term in Washington to talk about regime change. Ever since the Iraq War, you can just, you can see this sort of derision that comes with these discussions that, the United States is not good at this. I actually think that we're actually not terrible at overthrowing regimes. We're just not good at making new ones. And I think that that's where a lot of our tough lessons were learned, that state building is not exactly our forte. I do think that the U.S. tacitly supports this, or at least it thinks about kind of a soft landing where the current leadership is pushed out of the way for a different kind of Iran. I mean, this is basically what Secretary of State Pompeo talked about with his 12 points, that he just wants Iran to act like a normal country. Well, if Iran were to act like a normal country, it would be under different leadership, and it would have a completely different perspective on the rest of the world. So that might be a soft way of saying it. I don't want to put words in the administration's mouth, but certainly they certainly appear opposed to this regime as it is currently constructed. I think the Israelis are far more open about their antipathy for this regime. And by the way, it's not like the Israelis wanted this conflict. The Israelis, if you recall, had a wonderful relationship with the previous regime in Iran, have nothing but love for the Iranian people. And the Iranian people, by all indications, are not necessarily hostile to Israel or even the United States. It's the regime itself. And it's for that reason that I think there's an opportunity for these people to once again resume a government that channels the will of the people. And I just simply don't believe that this regime does that right now based on all available evidence. I think it's a regime that's not only hostile to the United States and Israel, but it's hostile to its own.
Thank you. I'm trying to think of a country where we have built a positive regime after Germany and Japan. I think you're right. That's not what we do. So Iran is embargoed by the UN from acquiring ballistic missile technology and building a ballistic missile program, and apparently they do it anyway. Could you talk about the current state, as you see it, of Iran's long-range ballistic missile program? Their PGMs are not long-range. You know, they want to put them over here and they want to put them over there, but how's the long-range program going?
I'm gonna respectfully keep this short, only because this is not my forte. I'm not a missile guy. I'm not a weaponry guy. I would actually recommend that if you'd like a deeper exploration of this, we have an excellent missile expert at NFDD. His name is Behnam Bentaleblu. He's an Iranian American, an amazing patriot, and someone who's really spent a huge amount of his life thinking about Iran and how it might change, and also looking at the weaponry that it currently has at its disposal. But suffice it to say, the Iranians have made strides in this space in an alarming way, because of course, you know, and this is one of the great flaws of the Iran nuclear deal, is that, you know, in 3 years from now, we're going to have the end of the ballistic missile restrictions. And of course, the delivery vehicle for nuclear weapons are ballistic missiles. So the question of why this was included in that fatally flawed nuclear deal to begin with is something that, I think many people continue to scratch their heads on. It's one of the reasons why the current debate on the arms embargo, the snapback at the UN, as well as the next sunset on ballistic missiles, all of this is incredibly important stuff that's being hashed out as we speak, and it will be important to look for ways for the United States and its allies to constrain these programs, even as the world disagrees on the utility of the 2015 nuclear deal, the JCPOA, whether it's revived in part, in whole, not at all. All of these things need to be looked at on a case-by-case basis, because these sunsets are coming due. The restrictions are going to begin to unravel quickly, and we're going to need serious leadership to address each of these, because each will be a crisis.
Thank you. To the listeners, Behnam Bentaleblu has an article in the current issue of InFocus with Mark Dubowitz and Richard Goldberg of FDD. It is a great article. Behnam is a great analyst. And so I recommend to you that you look at InFocus, but secondly, look at the article by Bentaleblu and Dubowitz and Goldberg. And again, you will learn things. So John, we are coming close to the end of the program, and I have only one rule in this program, and that is that the last question must have a positive answer. So I will ask you a question in which I hope your response is positive, so we can leave people on an up note. It's clear to me that Iran had aspirations again in Syria, in Lebanon, and Israel is in the business of dashing those hopes and aspirations piecemeal. How far do you think Iran has been set back? Do they look at Syria and they go, son of a gun, we meant to be over here and we're not, we're over there? Is Israel doing it?
Israel is. When we hear about near total dominance in Syria in terms of intelligence capabilities, that is a very nice thing to hear. You don't often hear that in assessments from anyone, that there is near total dominance. So that's important. I've also heard from sources that the original goal of Iran was to deploy 100,000 of its proxies and troops into Syria. And right now, the reality is less than 15,000, maybe even less than 10. So the Israelis, by the deterrence campaign, this campaign between wars, they have been able to stop the majority of those forces from being able to establish a beachhead inside Syria, certainly nowhere near the Israeli border. So that's good news. The fact that you have very few PGMs throughout Syria or Iraq, for that matter, also very good news. A little bit less good news when it comes to Lebanon, but I think there is a crisis that's going on there that may yet allow for a solution that addresses the debt and economic collapse that is now really, I mean, we're going to see a massive crisis unfold in Lebanon. I don't know if everybody on this call realizes how much deep trouble Lebanon is in economically. It will, I mean, has the potential to utterly bankrupt the country and to really spread poverty very quickly. And Hezbollah could be blamed for this. I mean, in many ways, this is Hezbollah's fault. The illicit finance, the corruption, the fact that they overtook the system and gutted it from the inside. This could have a way of blowing back on Hezbollah and redounding to Israel's benefit. And again, offering an opportunity to perhaps work with relevant authorities to remove the PGMs from the system or from the country, and perhaps even decoupling the country from Iran. So there are some very interesting things that are happening right now that could be leveraged well by the Israelis. But the biggest thing that I see as being, you know, a potential game changer and very positive is the fact that, you know, if again, these are not just happenstance occurrences that are taking place across Iran, it does look like someone is finally taking the fight to Iran itself. Iran has been largely insulated from all the mayhem that it's created around the region. It's never had to pay a price at home, or not in any real sense. Right now, it looks like they are literally putting out fires to try to keep the country intact. And that, to me, seems like a very positive thing indeed. It will probably afford them less bandwidth to think about creating mayhem elsewhere. So I'm sure that's something that everybody can be happy about.
So that's really remarkable, John, because I didn't think there was going to be a point of positive end to this conversation. But the idea that the Iranian people and the Lebanese people, for that matter, may find themselves with governments that are more tuned to their own needs and the people's needs rather than to the destruction of Israel and the destruction of the region, that is a positive note on which I'm going to say thank you very much on behalf of the many listeners today and on behalf of the JPC. And personally, thank you. This was great.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.